Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Massachusetts author John Fulton. John's short fiction has been awarded a Pushcart Prize, cited for distinction in the Best American Short Stories, shortlisted for the O. Henry Award, and published in numerous journals, including Zoetrope, Oxford American, and the Southern Review. He has also received grants and fellowships from the New York Writers Institute, Sewanee Writers Conference, the Vermont Studio Center, and the Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today, we'll be reading his story, Stitches, from his newly released collection, The Flounder. But first, let's listen to my interview with John, which took place on October 27th of this year. I'd like to welcome John Fulton to the podcast. We're going to be talking about John's most recent book, The Flounder, a Poets and Writers, Page One New and Noteworthy Book Selection. Welcome, John. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. I really enjoyed reading your book, The Flounder, your collection. It's really wonderful. And I can't wait to get into talking about those stories. But before we do, if you could tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I grew up in the Intermountain West, a little bit in the Mojave Desert, the Inland Empire of California, Montana, Utah, Wyoming, and really lived there all my life until I was about 19 and went to college and then decided I really needed to get away from that part of the world and kind of what I was most familiar with. And I went off to Europe for about 4 or 5 years. At that point, I decided I wanted to be a fiction writer. And a lot of the writers I read and admired in college, the modernists, they all did the same thing. And, you know, I also grew up in a pretty conservative family, and it was not really the place that was ideal for being inquisitive, being curious, reading, asking questions, all the things I think writers really need to do. So off to Europe I went, and I did all sorts of odd jobs like most writers. I was a chauffeur for a while. Mm-hmm. I was a translator once. I lived in German-speaking Switzerland and in Germany, and I learned the language and did some translating and taught English and really did all sorts of bit jobs so that I could read and write. It was a lot easier to kind of live like that then because I didn't really have many responsibilities. And I did that for 4 years before I left Berlin to do what a lot of writers do now, which is get an MFA degree. I thought I'd like to teach, and that's certainly one way that writers make a living. So I ended up getting into the University of Michigan's MFA program and returned to the States and got that degree and kind of lived the life that I'd lived before graduate school afterwards, which was, you know, working a number of different jobs. I was a ghostwriter and an editor for other writers and other kinds of books, some nonfiction books and self-help books, and then started publishing my first stories, sending them out, and just kind of gradually, you know, an agent contacted me. And I think it took, 4 or 5 years after my program to publish my first book, and then which was a collection of stories. And then I wrote a novel. I mean, the way it sort of worked, I do think I'm a little bit more of an intuitive short story writer than a novelist. But my agent basically said, I can't sell your stories alone. We have to sell it with a novel. So I sold it with an unwritten novel based on a short story I'd written. And then the year after that, I wrote the novel and published that. And then that was Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think I'd lived there 8 years and really started to kind of be comfortable in the Midwest. And since I had my first books out, started to apply for writing jobs, writing professorships. And that's how I ended up where I am now, which is in Boston with my family. I direct the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, really enjoy my students, and in general, am grateful for some distraction from the writing desk when things aren't going well. And I've really enjoyed mentoring young writers, what I'm doing now, as I kind of, you know, write my own work and continue to publish. So
you've covered a lot of ground in your life. You're a relatively young man. So, and you ended up in the Northeast in New England after growing up in desert country. What's that been like?
Well, it's interesting because I do think New England and Boston is one of those places where you can live for decades. And if you're not from there, you can still be an outsider, which is pretty atypical of this country, America. I mean, I know from living in Europe that, you know, if you're not from a place, you're going to be an outsider. And they can tell from simply your language. I guess you can in Boston, too. But I really, you know, I will be honest and say what I love about Boston is that there are so many like-minded people who care about the arts and literature. And where I came from, that's just not the way it was. It's still not that way. And I'm reminded of that when I go back. It's not as if there aren't enclaves of people who do appreciate those things. But, you know, I kind of came from a more of a working class culture and sometimes rural, too. So, yeah, I was just back there and did a little hunting with my father. And it's beautiful, beautiful country. But I definitely felt like I was in an element that was not appreciative of who I am and what I do.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you were anxious to get out into the world and you've done amazing things, obviously, in the time that you've been away from that other world, that other life. And we're going to talk about some of those things today. I want to talk about your book, The Flounder, that just came out.
It really came out in June of this year, so it's pretty new.
Yeah, and it's getting a lot of really positive attention. And the people who they got to write blurbs for this on the book cover are pretty spectacular. There's a blurb from Jennifer Haig, the author of Mercy Street, Brock Clark, the author of Who Are You, Calvin Bledsoe, Allegra Hyde. Before we get into talking about the stories, I just wanted to ask you about the business end of things, because people are always curious about the journey of a writer like you, who's accomplished quite a bit. And I think there's a lot to learn from someone like you. So maybe we'll just spend a few minutes talking about what it was like getting this particular book published. It not being the first, you, as you said, you have other books that were published prior to this, but this seems to have a little different kind of stature. Would you say that's true?
Yes and no. I'll say that it is my third story collection. And I know well that, you know, that's something that my agent wasn't particularly excited to hear. Because unfortunately, in general, and there are always exceptions, there are a lot of, or at least some exciting short story writers who actually make people money by writing short stories, but not that many. No. I can think of George Saunders, Alice Munro, and I start having trouble thinking of those after that. I mean, there are a lot of short story writers who are publishing books, but not the kind that people actually make a living off of. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always that you run into as a story writer. I mean, I do write novels as well. I've only published one of those. And I'll be honest that I have one in my head right now, but I seem to be working on more stories. So the status of a short story writer that actually publishes multiple books is a very mixed one, because it's actually hard to publish a collection of stories. Probably the easiest collection of stories to publish is your first one, because the way large houses see them is a kind of, as my editor at Picador said many years ago when I published my first, this will be an appetizer for your novel. I love that metaphor.
It's not a meal. It's just an appetizer.
But that is clearly the way New York thinks. And so they tend to be okay with publishing an initial collection. And then they think about the novel and the next novel. And so that said, there are a lot of people out there who do read short story collections. And it is not easy to publish your second and third collection. And usually it's going to happen through a university press or a small independent press. And certainly that was the case for me. My first collection came out with Picador USA. Then my novel came out with Picador and actually got picked up by Random House in the UK and did quite well. And, you know, they wanted the next novel, and I had a short story collection, and they were kind of interested in that. And so, you know, I published that through Louisiana State University, my second collection, which was called The Animal Girl. And unfortunately, I thought I would publish my next one with them, but like so many presses, they got their budget cut pretty dramatically during COVID. So with my third collection, I had to find a new and different small press, which is how I came across Blackwater. And really, it's just a matter of sending the work out and talking to different editors. And you really have to be careful with small presses, first of all, because so many of them fail so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, because some of them aren't entirely professional and you have to be able to figure out who they are. But, you know, I wouldn't publish with anybody that I couldn't be in touch with very quickly and have conversation with and who didn't know literature and know the writers I read and the tradition I'm writing in. And that's the most important thing for me.
Yeah.
So when I started sending this collection out, you know, I was having conversations with presses that are interested in it. And when I talked to my current editor, I just knew he was right for the book immediately. So yeah, the life of a short story writer is, it's both exciting and sort of predictably disappointing in some ways. But
yeah, it's a sad reality that I hope, you know, at some point will change. It seems like things go in cycles. Maybe the short story will have another heyday sometime in the near future. But I get frustrated for writers like you whose work is so remarkable and, you know, I feel deserves to be more widely read. And I feel your frustration. So I hope this book finds its audience. It really deserves to.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, the stories in this collection, have most of them been previously published in journals?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that's the kind of exciting thing, is connecting with an editor in the small magazine world. So I'll send off my work to various literary journals that I admire. And that's also not an easy process because, the journals have limited space and there are only a certain number of good ones. So these have been published in the Missouri Review, The Sun, which is one of my favorite venues to publish in, Plowshares, which is a really wonderful magazine out of Emerson College.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's always exciting to have the first life of a story be, you know, in a small journal. And I read those and have read them ever since I was a student and encourage my students to read them because that's where the newest stuff is coming out.
Right. And without them, most of the people who are writing short stories would have no other outlet to have their work read from. So yeah, they're very important. Do you set out when you write a story, just having it be a standalone story without any thought given to the possibility of it ending up in a collection? Or are you always kind of thinking in the back of your mind, I may thread this together with something else that I'm working on or think about subsequent stories building towards a collection? What's your thought process generally as far as that goes?
That's a great question. And I can say a lot about it, but I'll just say that my process usually is to think about the integrity of an individual story that I'm working on and not to think about something larger because, you know, the story itself is pretty darn hard. It's a challenge. But for whatever reason, lately I've been writing about two characters, Daniel and Marion, that have been showing up in several my stories, and two of which are in this collection, but I also just completed two, one of which just appeared in the last issue of the Missouri Review. And I'm writing another quite long, probably a novella about them now. And I'll be honest and say that that's more or less an accident. It's not an accident in the sense that, you know, when I'm writing it, obviously I'm making decisions and I'm using the craft that I have at my disposal, and well, none of that is an accident, but I have to say whatever it is that moves me at a given time bothers me enough to actually feel that I need to try to make it a story. that's never, for me anyway, intentional. It's something where I'm sort of following a kind of thought process, a kind of intuitive creative process that, you know, I don't try to bother myself too much with understanding, because I don't think we really need to. We just, you know, need to be attentive and receptive to it. And, but I will say that I think that collections do have an integrity. And one of the things that I regret most about the way we're educated when we start to read short fiction is that we're reading these wonderful stories in isolation, as if they were written simply to be read alone. And that's because a lot of us, when we're in school or even college, are reading anthologies. So, you know, whatever the classic story might be, The Yellow Wallpaper, To Build a Fire, or, you know, The Things They Carry by Tim O'Brien, I could go on and on. We think about these stories as if they were written in isolation. And that's certainly not the way I like to read stories. I really like to see them in a collection that the author has put together, because I do feel like what we're seeing in most collections is what has preoccupied and interested a mind during a specific period of an artist's life. And that is something completely unique to that writer. And I do kind of feel like a good collection, like a good novel, has structure and shape. And I would not say progression or even development in a way that's novelistic, but some kind of inner logic that comes from the fact that the artist was writing these at a particular time in their lives and were thinking and preoccupied by particular things that simply have to do with lived experience.
You make a really excellent point there. I have to agree, when I read collections, you really do get a sense of the author in a unique way, you know, different than you would if you were reading a novel, because with each story, you're kind of discovering another facet of the writer. And I certainly found that to be the case in reading The Flounder. Let's talk about some of these stories. The first thing I wanted to commend you for is your willingness to go long with these stories. Some of them go into probably like the 10,000 plus word range.
I always experience a certain amount of frustration when I'm at the desk and I realize, oh no, this is another long story. Partially because they're actually very hard to publish in small magazines. A lot of small magazines don't want anything longer than 5,000 words. A lot don't want longer than 7,000. There are just a few of them that will read 10,000 and over, and there are good reasons for that. It's really expensive to send out a heavy book in the mail, and these places, thank goodness, still care about producing actual paper-bound journals. And it's expensive to print them, so I understand that. And by taking long pieces, they're not going to take a certain number of shorter pieces, so it's very practical.
For me, that is what I'm always excited about when I see writers writing longer stories. And you are going way longer than most people that I'm reading. But when you're getting into the 10,000 plus word territory and approaching the novella almost, it allows you to create a world in a very different way. So maybe you could just talk about the whole idea of kind of building that world slowly over that amount of time and those many pages.
Yeah, sure. And I love the long story form. I love the novella. It's a little hard to tell if there's a difference between those. We could argue about word count and pages. But I do think that the long form story does both what the short story does and a bit of what the novel does. It is, you know, you can speak of it as a short novel or a compressed novel, or you can speak of it as a long story. I mean, a real genuine short story, let's say 7 to 15 pages or so, you're really looking at the end as soon as you write that first paragraph. And the artistry of that is compression. And a really good short form writer is talented at implying a lot, is talented at subtext. So when you start to write the longer form, you're under more pressure actually to keep developing and complicating what you've begun. And I think that can be hard and a special challenge in the long form story in a different way than, say, the novelist has. Because one of the things the novelist does is the novelist tells several stories, right?
Mm.
Often shifting point of view, looking at this character and that character, and each character has kind of a story arc, and there are a lot of balls to juggle, but that's kind of what they're doing. Whereas I think the long form story is making a pledge and a promise to the reader that you're going to keep showing them something new and nuanced about the same situation you begin with. And as soon as you start to reiterate and repeat, you're in trouble.
Hmm.
So you have to kind of create the same intensity that the shorter form creates while also giving the reader the pleasure of expansion. You know, so whatever that conceit that you begin with, infidelity, dysfunction, difficulty in a family, you know, trouble between father and son. If you're going to write a 10,000 word story there, you have to keep showing your reader something new about that. And I think that for me, I don't sit out and decide to do that. That's just kind of something that happens, and I have to follow the next development to its end. And if it doesn't conclude, then I keep going. So I think, you know, you're basically dealing with something that contains both compression and expansion, and your characters need to be larger in the longer form. And yet, one of the things I think that's so enjoyable about it is that your patient reader could still read the story in a sitting or two, which is what I think makes the short story very unique and different from the novel, where unless you have all day or the weekend, you're going to necessarily experience it over a longer period of time with interruptions and all of that. Short story gives you access to the full vision in one go.
Mm. And it's important that the reader be compelled to read the story to its end, as opposed to the novel, where you, in most cases, you're going to put it down and then pick it up again. But that's a lot to put on the writer, you know, to make sure that they maintain the interest of their reader. And, you know, that's something you manage to do in your stories, even though there's a lot of interior monologue going on often. I just wanted to quote from one of the blurbs. I think it was Nicholas Del Banco said that you have an eye for detail, both telescopic and microscopic. And I thought that was just so well put, because you can create these expansive landscapes for your characters, but then so often they turn inward and we take a really deep dive into their inner thoughts and their inner world. And it's really easy for that to fail in the hands of someone who is not as assured as you clearly are. But those are the parts that, for me, were most satisfying. These couples, and it seems like there's a lot of couples in these stories. Some are married, some have just kind of happened upon one another and form temporary connections. And one of the things that you, I think, do differently than I've read in other male writers is your ability to handle intimacy is kind of unique and wonderful. And there's a lot of intimacy in these stories. Physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, and often there's a lot of discomfort in the intimacy and uncertainty. And that, I think that's a hard thing to convey in writing, but you manage to capture this sense of discomfort that the reader can really feel in the reading of these descriptions of, you know, these interactions with the characters. So maybe you could talk a little bit about writing about intimacy and what that's like for you as a writer.
That's really interesting. I think, I think that intimacy has a tension, an inherent tension to it, right? Because it's interesting to think of how difficult it is to actually get close to another person, right? You're taking inherent risk. And while we like to kind of think about romance as sort of something that's sentimental and easy, and it certainly gets a lot of stories in our culture, I don't think that we maybe give enough time and thought to how dangerous it is and how uncomfortable it is, because, of course, we're risking pain and rejection and you know, the possibility that what we have to give or show is not what that other person wants. And yeah, I think that that's something that for whatever reason I gravitate towards. I mean, there's necessary complexity to it. And I think that when the social masks come off, I mean, you know, for me, when I'm thinking about a character, I think that there are these moments that are especially charged that don't always have to do with straightforward conflict or tension or the idea that there's an antagonist and a protagonist and they're going to go head to head and that's going to be resolved in one way or another. But rather that what's going to happen to that character is that a kind of mask is going to come down and something will be revealed that surprises both the character and I hope the reader, and usually me as the writer, that we sort of, you know, see something that we haven't been able to see because masks are interesting, right? And when they're up, they have their own complexities and that creates tension in the story too. But when they come down, I think we, if it's done well by the writer, if it's earned in the story, I think that it moves and interests the reader. And certainly when people are honest and when things get intimate, masks tend to be exposed as such and that they do come down. And yeah, I think that that is something that a lot of the time I'm kind of, you know, working towards, especially when I'm writing about couples, romance. And and I also think that it's interesting in families and when we sort of are able to see something about somebody we think we knew or we thought we knew, but in fact, we don't, right? Not fully.
No.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, what intimacy is. Yes, it can be comforting, but it can also show us things that are difficult to see.
The characters in these stories, they seem to be trying to recover from earlier traumas often. In a number of stories, this central character is talking about a family where the father has abandoned the mother, and usually it's just a single child. I'm just curious how that seems to be a thread through many of these stories.
Yeah, certainly abandonment is in this collection, and it comes up again and again. And I was raised by a single mom, so I'm sure that from my life, I got to know my dad later in life, and he's probably an inherently difficult guy to know. But I also didn't know him when I was a little kid, so that relationship is certainly formed by that, and that material will probably always seep into my work. I do think that what's interesting about relationships and what comes, you know, when I think about my stories, say the story, What Kent Boyd Had, which is what I call a list story. It's about this guy who starts off in a very humble position with almost nothing, living with a single mother in a very rural part of the West. And he rises up and becomes a lawyer and goes to Berkeley for college and ends up in Boston and marries a pretty well-off woman who grew up in New England. But the story takes the form of a list of all the things this guy accumulates over his life. And it's what I call a chronicle story. I've always loved chronicle stories. It tries to sort of contain a whole life from beginning to end and give us a portrait of that life. And, you know, what kind of held my interest as I was writing the list of all the things this guy was able to accumulate was that certain parts of the list were things that made him uncomfortable and didn't really express success, the kind of success he felt he had achieved in his life. And those things that didn't fit were also the things, right, that revealed his vulnerabilities in his humanity and his weaknesses. And, you know, really, I think about that story and probably it's more a story of the marriage than anything else. I didn't realize that as I was writing it, but I, you know, we realize things about our work as we go out and give readings and talk about it. It's really about his marriage to a woman who he loves dearly and who kind of brings out his vulnerabilities, because the very thing he needs most, which is sort of reassurance and acknowledgement and recognition of just how great a guy he is. He's kind of that guy. He's that kind of guy, right?
Yeah.
I know it's based in also some fairly honest insecurity that comes from growing up with very little. His wife is kind of distant, and it's hard for her to give him those things, right? And that causes problems for him. And it also allows me as a writer to kind of complicate his character and really show the opposite side of that bravado, which is vulnerability, and which is neediness. And I think the other thing that I didn't realize I was writing about in this collection was aging. You know, and that's a story also about a guy who gradually gets to the end of his life. And you know, I think perhaps because I'm in my 50s now, and I'm starting to think about that process a little bit more than I want to.
It brought to mind, although it's really nothing like it, other than it being a chronicle story, it brought to mind F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Because I had the same feeling when I got to the end of that story that I did reading Benjamin Button, this sense of sadness that this man, for all he'd accomplished, he realizes at the end that it seemed like a lot while it was happening, but it really turned out to be not so much. But you know what? That's okay. I took out an excerpt. I just want to read it because it really moved me. Had he had, among everything else that composed the sum total of his life, something or things that made all the years amount to something, it all rushed by, though not before he could come up with the answer again, simple if not entirely satisfying, that he'd had a life for what it was worth. And that would have to be enough. He held on to the thought, hoping to keep it this time before it too slipped away. That's just beautiful. And this is one of those stories that's not, it's short on plot. There really isn't a plot. It's just about the things that have occurred in this man's life. When I got to the end of that story, I was surprised at how absorbed I had gotten in it as I thought back to what actually transpired in the story. But it's more about what this man is feeling in relation to all the people around him, the people that he loves. And that's a hard thing to accomplish, I think, as a writer, to create that feeling in a reader through those means. So
I'm glad. Of course, that's what we're trying to do is move and interest people.
The Flounder is the last story in the book, and we're getting near the end of the hour. So maybe we'll end with The Flounder. This is about that couple, Marion and Daniel, that you seem to have taken a greater interest in and are writing more about their story. And this is the second story in this collection about them. In this story, they're having some marital issues. They're fighting and something's happened. You know, we won't go into detail, but they're living in Europe and they decided to take a trip to the French countryside, hoping that that might help. But everything that can possibly go wrong seems to be going wrong for them. And the characters at this inn who run this inn are kind of magical. And this story has a sort of magical realism flavor to it, wouldn't you say? Which is different from the other stories, I would say.
Definitely. Yeah.
There is one where there is a little bit of magical realism. And again, it involves a couple who are fighting. And something happens during that story that kind of moves into the magical realism realm. How did that emerge in the story? Was that something that just kind of organically found its way into the story as you were writing it?
I mean, I would say organic is always the right word, and hopefully the process that happens for me. When I'm starting to force things, I know that I'm not working in the direction that the story needs to go. But The Flounder is actually, the title comes from a Grimm's fairy tale that I first came across when I was living in German-speaking Switzerland in my early 20s and learning German. I read the Grimm's fairy tales and discovered just how beautiful and gruesome and brutal the stories are. And the fairy tale is better known as The Fisherman and His Wife. It's often called that. But when I read it, it started to obsess me. And it's a very simple story. Fisherman goes out, catches a fish. The fish is magic and talks to him and says, if you put me back, I'll give you three wishes. And of course he does. He goes to his wife, and his wife then says, well, I want to have a palace. And he goes back, and there's the fish. He says, we want a palace. And the fish says, okay, go home. It's there. And he does. And the palace is there. And his wife says, okay, I want all the gold and power of the king. He goes back to the fish. The fish says, you got it. Go back. And, you know, he goes back, and he's the king. And then the wife says, all right, I want to be God. Everything that God has, that's what I want. So he goes back to the fish, and the fish says, all right, you got it. And he goes back, and their original hovel is there, and the wife is there, and basically smiling, which is the big surprise of the story, and serving a bowl of something like stone soup, and they're content, right? And that really bothered me when I read it. It was both powerful and just confounding, because while the wife and the fisherman are happy, the reader is not happy. And I thought a lot about that. You know, that story, The Flounder, is, as you said, it's about this young couple who are going on a vacation. But I'll give this away, and it's not giving much away, because it's there in the first paragraph. They're going on the eve of when one of them admits to infidelity. So that's not an ideal way to embark on a vacation, but off they go. And, you know, that story, I didn't know right away that it would come out, but it is retold as this couple tries to figure out how to move forward. What's going to happen? How do you mend the kind of wound that infidelity is? And the telling of that story just kind of captured me, because it's really about the riddle of desire. And, you know, that story Kent Boyd is too. As soon as you have one thing, you want another. And as soon as you got that, you want another, you want another, you want another. And that is a problem that nobody knows how to solve, except for the Grimms, which is to take desire away. And once desire is gone, you've solved it, but that's not what we want either. Mm. And so, you know, this young couple is trying to figure out, what do we want? What do we want from each other? How can we give it to each other? And they're, you know, the magic kind of comes out of the fairy tale. They're living in Switzerland, which is like the most pragmatic, down to earth sort of culture you can imagine. It's about money and doing things right and things working. And they go to France, which is a real counterpoint to Switzerland. That's not about things working. It's about passion and desire and maybe dangerous decisions, right? And once they get into France, the storm hits and you kind of enter through a portal. And, you know, the hotel they go to is very isolated, and they eat a meal that's served to them by the hotel wife and her husband, who have a kind of sensuality about them and ease and a sense of warmth that is, you know, it is that dark forest that takes you in and you get lost. And the couple do, they get lost there. But they also maybe start to understand some things about themselves. And that's where the magic in the story, I think, takes over. And, you know, again, that's got to be a spell. It's got to feel organic. It's got to feel like it's very much part of the weave and warp of the story. In some ways, that material comes from the time when I was living in Europe during my early 20s. And those fairy tales informed both of those stories and the magic that takes place in them. Mm. I mean, they're really realist stories, but they have a kind of lit darkness in them that comes really from the Brothers Grimm in some way.
Europe plays a large role in many of these stories. Many of them are set in Switzerland. I think one is in Budapest, the couple... Yes. That was the one that was sort of like a Before Sunrise type story, where a young woman and a man meet on a train and end up spending some time together in the city of Budapest. So there is a real kind of European flavor throughout this book. And that's another thing that is always fun to read when an American writer is kind of filtering their European experience through their work, because you do a beautiful job of creating those worlds, those environments. Your descriptions of them are always so evocative. And this is one of the many joys of reading this book. On so many levels, the reader is going to get so many different kinds of experiences. And that final story, it's the perfect way to end the collection. And I just want to say thank you for writing all of these. And it was a total joy getting to read the book front to back.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for the conversation and the feedback from a wonderful and sensitive reader like yourself. That means something.
My pleasure, John. This is what fills my life with joy. And I just have to tell everyone listening, they should go right out and buy a copy of The Flounder. Christmas is coming up. They should get copies as gifts, because it really, it's an incredible collection. And I hope it does well. So thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule today to join me.
Thank you, John.
You'll find more about John and his writing on his website, johnfulton.net. And now we'll move on to the short story. Today I'll be reading Stitches, which was first published in the Alaska Quarterly Review. So here it is, Stitches by John Fulton. You and your father are out in the fields hunting pheasants on a cold fall day and under an open sky, into which a flock of geese from the reservoir far below rises into a V. You follow the birds, squinting into the sun, until they grow distant, like dirty flecks, smaller and smaller, and until some inner sense of danger, something bad is about to happen, you think, makes you look down just in time to see your father topple over. His chest and shoulders and gun disappear into the thick cover and hit the ground with a dull thud that seems to land on your chest, sucking the air from your lungs. Your father is old, well into his 70s, and almost frail, and you, now a father yourself, on this trip because you want to know him better before it's too late, experience the pain of the impact as if you were the one to have fallen. You run to where he lies on the ground and look down. Later, at the emergency room, you recall how you found him, deep in the weeds on his back, unable to move at first, struggling for breath even as he smiled, perhaps because he is that kind of man, quiet, inward, too embarrassed to show distress, though a splash of blood covered the fingers that staunched the deep cut on his chin, and he couldn't rise without taking your hand. You felt him trembling as you pulled him up, though it wasn't his weakness that bothered you. It was something more, something you couldn't make out then. Had a little accident, he says now, to the woman doctor in blue scrubs. She is attractive, young, and he does what he has always seemed compelled to do with women, trying to charm her, even smiling, though as soon as his lips curl into a grin, he startles with pain and pulls his lips flat again. The doctor chats about her two kids, a girl and a boy. They're a lot of fun, she says, slowly sinking the needle into your father's face, then gracefully pulling the thread upward, and with a cinch of the wrist, closing the corner of the cut. But they fight like cats and dogs. Just a few more, she says, adding, with a glance at you, it's nice that you and your father can come out here and hunt together. Even as she says this, sinking the needle into his face again, you lift your hand as if by reflex and touch an old scar just below your lower lip, and feel the strange space of a story, something that happened a long time ago, opening up inside you, wide like the sky below which your father just fell. It's a story which you remember more vividly than you want to, and that seems about to disappear again into all the space inside you, a space you don't often fathom. But the story doesn't disappear. It isn't as if you've ever forgotten it, but you do go about with it, as you do with most memories, as if it had never been there, as if you were the product always of this moment now, as if you had never been anything other than this man, this father, this husband, this professor who gets his children up in the morning, takes them to school, goes to the university, greets his colleagues in the halls, teaches his students, eats dinner with his family, reads in bed, kisses his wife before turning out the light, makes love to her if he's lucky, goes to sleep and gets up again, as if you'd never been more or less than this, as if the scar on your lower lip that you finger now as you watch the doctor pull the needle through and up once again with easy finesse. "Just a few more, and we'll be all done," she says cheerily, as if that scar were not there, and as if your father had never left your mother and you, too, many years ago, so many years ago that you, then a small boy, could never remember having had a father. You just remember him being gone. You remember, or think you do, a white envelope on a kitchen table that your mother opened to find a letter from your father and her husband informing her that he had left. He had joined the army or been drafted, this being a time of war, and somehow he had kept this from his wife, or so the story goes, until he had already gone and she had come home to read his letter. And you, a very small boy, not able to read, could only know the story your mother, now dead nearly 10 years, told you at the time and repeated through the years of your childhood. And though you, a man now, standing in a clinic watching his father receive stitches, hardly recall being this boy and go about your days as if he never existed, he is there now, evoked clearly enough in that interior space. The boy crouches beside his mother at the kitchen table, the letter in her hands, as she says, "He left us. He's gone." The boy and his mother seem to wait, the letter out on the table, for days, for weeks, for months, for the man to return. And when he does not, they try to go to him. They mount a shiny flight of metal stairs and climb into an airplane, the engines of which make a scary racket. The boy has never flown before and isn't prepared for the earth below to grow small, to disappear, for there to be nothing but air and clouds, isn't prepared for his mother trembling beside him, even as the pretty stewardesses, who wear blue outfits and little hats like upside-down cones, look at them with a sweet calm that the boy wishes his mother could feel, because it might mean he could feel it too. The country they arrive in is broad and strange. It stretches farther than the land does at home, so that the boy feels smaller here. And it is cold. Patches of snow lie on the gray earth. And when people speak, the boy can't understand their words, and neither, this much is clear from her face, can his mother. But what you remember almost more than anything else is that this boy who cannot yet read somehow knows, how could this be, where to go and how to find his father, whom he doesn't remember. Perhaps the boy knows this because his mother needs him to know it. The boy, it is clear enough to you now, will have many resources that he probably should not have because his mother lacks them. It is as if a man already formed, already full grown, were inside him. And so the boy leads the way. "Get in this car, mother," he says. "Get in this bus. Get in this train. Follow me. It's down this road." And so the boy finds his way to a house on the side of an icy street. His father emerges from the front door, looking nothing like the old man who lies on the table now as a woman sews him up. He is taller back then, broader in the shoulders. He wears a uniform with shiny insignias on it, and peers out into the cold air, squinting, though the air is not bright, with such intensity and disbelief that the boy has the strong sensation of being seen from the outside, can even see himself, a small, round-faced kid, a little husky, standing in front of his mother, whose eyes are dark and hard with accusation. "What are you doing here?" the man asks. Behind him, a woman leans casually against the doorframe, so casually that even the boy, as young as he is, understands that she lives in that house, that her presence means something irrevocable. Her smile is welcoming, but there is a sheen in her eyes that doesn't want them there. A wind blows her dress backwards, and she crosses her arms and hugs herself. What happens next, you, standing in the clinic, cannot quite put together. You know only that the man comes out of the house in his thick coat and leads the boy and his mother out into the icy road because he wants them far away from the house and the woman inside. And in truth, the boy wants that too.
But the road seems incredibly wide, and the boy fears that he will never make it to the other side. His father is in front of him, and his mother is too far behind him. The ice on the road is thick, and the boy is unable to get his footing, and so he stops. He calls to his father, who is tall, towering, his hands huge at the end of his long arms. "Help me! Hold my hand!" And his mother shouts from behind the boy, too far behind him to do anything, "Take his hand! He needs your help!" And standing out ahead of him, the man says, "You're a big boy. You can cross the road yourself." But he is not big. In the middle of this road, he feels small, and so he turns and lunges for his father, who does not reach for him. The boy feels his feet kick out, and his face hit the ice hard, his chin splitting open to the bone in the place where you prod at the scar now, just beneath the lower lip, in the same place, or very near it, where your old father, sitting up, pale, his eyes groggily looking around as if he weren't sure about the world anymore, has a thick line of sutures, the cut closed up as tightly as that memory closes up inside you now, growing comfortably distant, though you do just register the faint reverberations of what that boy, bleeding on the ice, furious in only the way a small boy can be, wants to shout out but doesn't, because he too is already learning to stay silent, to smile or just keep a dull-eyed stare when he feels pain or anger or panic. "Why didn't you take my hand? Why? I needed your hand." And you recall again offering your hand in the field to your old father. He was trembling, and when he took your hand, he squeezed so tightly that you knew he was afraid, never mind his smile. "We're all done," the woman doctor says, grinning, even as she looks with concern, too much concern, you think, into your father's face, as if peering down a dark hole and trying to see to the bottom of it. Because he took a blow to his head, she already asked him a battery of simple questions. His name, his birth date and place, where he was, his son's name, that he was able to answer, smiling, saying, "Am I all here, Doc?" "You seem to be," she said. But now she hands you a sheet of symptoms and tells you to wake him every 2 hours that night, with orders to bring him in if he is confused or hard to wake. Outside now, the world seems overly large, emptier than you remember it. And as if to confirm this impression, your father cranes his head up and looks out, seeming to expect a clear limit, something to hold the distance in closer, and worried not to find one. Your father is not to get behind the wheel, doctor's orders, for at least another day, and so you drive his large truck. The land is flat as far as you can see, with only a few box-like buildings, little houses, and the shadowy outlines of mountains on the distant edge. Here and there over the flatness you spy huge green tractors dragging rows of metal claws into the muddy earth. "Sugar beet harvest," your father says. "It's a big cash crop. They do all right around here. You live in a faraway city and aren't used to this vastness. You don't know much about farmers of any sort, about cash crops. You aren't used to the large vehicle you drive now, the way it thrusts you above everything and seems to crush the ground below it. And although as an older boy you hunted on a few occasions with your father, whom you never lived with, whom you only saw on long weekends or over vacations, you are no longer used to shooting things, to killing them, or trying to. Perhaps it's fortunate that you've had no success over the last few days, though you feel a surprising sense of failure, an almost shameful one that makes you self-conscious because at your age, nearly 50, you are too old for such small feelings. Wondering about your family now, you call home. "I suppose you're having a good time out there," your wife says, unable to suppress a harriedness in her voice, a slight irritation because you left at a busy time. She has a lot to do at work. The kids are calling loudly in the background. "Is it Daddy? It's Daddy! It's Daddy!" And their eager voices make you miss them and experience a guilt that is too large for an absence of only a few days. You blame it on all the space out here. It confuses you. It makes the world inside you, the feelings there, larger than it should be. You blame it on your old father, sitting groggily beside you, who really did leave his family forever and whose guilt you seem to be feeling now, perhaps because he never felt it, or seemed to feel it, himself. And this guilt makes you worry, as if you're going to be gone a long time and not just a few days. Makes you ask, is everything all right there? Just fine, your wife says. I love you all, you tell her. Tell the kids I love them. And you do love them, your boy and girl. And think now how you will be home soon and hug them tightly. Hold them. Let them know how much you love them. Let them know that you will never be gone for long.
But why didn't your father love you in this same way?
Why did he leave you and your mother? You've asked him before, but he has never given an answer that satisfied your sense of justice. We weren't compatible, he said. We were two different people, he said. Recently, as the weather turned cold, you began dreaming about your father. Every night, it seemed. And although you could never remember the dreams, the sense of them lingered. When you woke in the mornings, you struggled to reassemble them, but all you saw was a blue sky with the naked branches of trees clutching at clouds overhead. The gentle rush of water meant a river was somewhere nearby, and with that river came a feeling you only recognized from the absence of it in your life. It was the feeling of having a father, of always having had one, nearby, a feeling as big and reassuring as the bed below you, the sheets wrapped around you, so that you held to them and didn't want to let go. But soon you had to, and as you rose from bed and dressed, as you ate breakfast, took your kids to school, went to work, this feeling would once again be replaced by its absence. You talked to your wife about these dreams, your urgency to see him given his age, and she encouraged you to go. Do it now, she said. And so you are here, feeling this strange guilt, regretting your wife's irritation, never mind her earlier encouragement, missing your children as if you had betrayed them. But now you stop the truck. Look at that, you say, excited and a little afraid. What is it? Your wife asks over the phone.
You'd better get out there, your father says.
I've got to put the phone down, you say, hearing your wife's voice grow small. What is it? She's still asking, as you take your gun from behind the seat and are already outside in the road. It's too easy. The bird is right there on the roadside. For 2 days, you and your father have beaten through the underbrush,
the dogs running out ahead,
and only flushed a handful of pheasants, all of which you missed with the first shot, and your father, never mind his hands and arms that shake from age, got with the second.
You need to lead the bird, your father says.
The sky is orange with sunset. The gun feels heavy and cold. You're sure you'll miss again. Then the bird goes up. You shoulder the gun, fire, and it comes careening down. I got it, you shout, hearing a clap of celebratory laughter. Your father's, coming from the truck. You're surprised to hear your wife's frightened voice a moment later on the phone, again asking, are you all right? I heard a gunshot. Your father is smiling with approval, shaking his head in the dark truck cab. Good shot, son, he says. And you laugh. I shot a bird, you say. You killed a bird? Your wife seems almost upset, which only makes you more aware of your own embarrassing happiness, the size and scale of it. It's too much to feel over such a small thing. And you try to repress what must be a silly, over-eager smile, full of teeth. You try to wipe it from your face, but you can't. And the harder you try, the more the emotion just grows. A big, boyish feeling, something like glee and pride. Your father shakes his head and says, after you hand him the dead bird, "That's a good-sized rooster." You hear your son. He's 5, and you imagine him craning over his mother's shoulder to catch the conversation. Shout out, "Daddy shot a bird! He shot a bird!" How happy his excitement, and your father's too, makes you. But it is an unreliable happiness, as you know from the dreams you've been having. It fades too soon, uses you up, and leaves you emptier than before. And it is this emptiness that begins to set in when you drive toward your father's small camper, which sits out on the flat land alone. Your father climbs slowly from the truck and teeters for a moment when he finds the ground, though he thrusts his arms out to ward you away when you offer help. He opens the dog's crates and they bolt out and leap from the truck bed, In a circle of light from a lantern, he lays the bird over the tailgate, rips the feathers away, and cuts out the breast meat, red and glistening like a heart, and places it tenderly on a slab of wood. It's night now, the air growing cold, and your breath rises in white trails. Icy flakes of stars fall upwards at the top of the sky, and the horizon seems all at once to close in around you. You can see almost nothing outside the light cast by the lantern, though you hear the huff and scamper of the dogs running in the near distance, and see their shapes flash in and out of the dark. Inside the small trailer, your father begins to make dinner at the hissing stove. He opens a bottle and pours out two glasses. The alcohol and the little blue flame from the burner begin to warm you. "It's a good thing you made that shot," your father says, cutting up vegetables and the meat. "Otherwise, we'd be eating chili from a can tonight." And you experience a flicker of that well-being again. But it is gone by the time your father places the steaming plates of food down and sits across from you. The circle of light at the table is bright enough, though a dimness seeps into the corners and edges of the trailer and makes you aware of the miles of darkness outside from where a wind picks up and beats against the window beside you. You eat, and perhaps the food is especially good, salty and peppery and rich with brown gravy over it, because you shot the bird. Your father asks, "What did you do differently this time when you hit it?" He wants you to learn something, and so you cooperate. You say, "I let it."
"Well," he says, nodding, "there you go."
He talks about sports. "They like their football out here," he says, "and though he doesn't follow the team you do, you can stay with him. You can talk about who won and lost last season and what might happen this season." He talks about the water pump he just replaced in the trailer where you're eating now. "Last week, the toilet wouldn't flush. Now it works like new." He talks about the wind that blows outside, coming in gusts that hit the trailer and make it shudder, and that makes you think again of the distance all around. It's covered in darkness now, but it's there nonetheless. "The wind starts every year in September," your father says, "blows right up until the beginning of April. It keeps the people away, never mind how beautiful it is out here. That's how I like it, without the people," he says. "Without the people," you think. That is how he likes it. He looks toward the window and smiles. He talks about the metal roof he just put on the dormers of his cabin, and how the snow will slide off it this winter. You look down at his hand, the one he's eating with, and see that it's shaking. It always seems to be shaking. You say, "You shouldn't be up on the roof." He is slow to answer and only does so after taking another forkful of food. "Probably not," he says, "but now I've got a good roof up there." Roofs, water pumps, football, the wind. You've more or less had this conversation before and will no doubt have it many times again. And so you say, "Why don't you come see us? The kids would like that." In fact, he used to come on rare occasions, every few years. But that was some time ago, and he never seemed to know what to make of the children. After all, he never had one of his own. There was you, but he didn't know you until you were older, 8 or 9. Your kids only seemed to startle him, their volume and energy holding him captive at the kitchen table with his newspaper. "Boarding airplanes, going all that way," he says, sighing. "I'm getting too old for that." "But you were up on a roof," you say. He nods slowly, seeming to think. You look at him then, his face thin, pale in the yellow light, too much like a skull, with his dark eyes like shining absences. Only then do you see the bruises, ugly rings of grayish blue beneath his eyes, which must have come from the blow to his head. He is staring seemingly at nothing, his gaze tilted down. "Are you all right?" And when he doesn't answer, you say louder, as if he were outside in the wind and you were calling to him, "Dad?" He makes a kind of sound, though whether it's an acknowledgement of you, you can't say. "Dad," you say, recalling the doctor's warning, suddenly afraid for this old man. "Can you tell me your name?" After what feels like too long, he says, "Frank Sinatra." He smiles, because he got you, wincing as he does so. But his eyes are still open in that stare. The face, his face, around them as still as a mask. And then he does something that startles you, makes you sit back an inch or two away from him. He lifts his hand. It seems too large, not quite human in scale, swollen at the knuckles, the nails beaten and dull with black flecks where blood scabs form. and seems about to touch you, to grasp softly, blindly at your face. But instead he touches himself, prodding gently at the new stitches, a gesture that brings water to his eyes, opens them wider, and lets you see right into them and back to the clinic where you stood in the corner, your hand prodding your scar as you consider the boy on the icy road, as you see that boy wanting to scream, angry, furious as only a child can be, but nonetheless staying quiet. And all at once you feel that this isn't your thought but your father's, or perhaps both of yours together. The trailer, the circle of light in which you sit now, looking into his eyes, the clinic in which you stood in the corner, looking back at the boy. There is too much space out here. You wish you were in your cramped city in bed with your wife. But you are right. It is his thought, or both of yours together, because the anger you feel seems to bring his eyes up to yours, as if he registers it when you do, and when you ask about an incident you have never before discussed with him. Why the hell didn't you take my hand? I needed you to take my goddamn hand. He doesn't flinch. He doesn't shake his head. He doesn't ask when or where. Outside, the wind slams into the trailer and shakes it. He says, "That was a long time ago." And then he adds, "You were so upset." "Damn right I was," you say. "I found you. I came from a long way away and found you. And then I asked for your hand. Why didn't you fucking give it to me? I was a boy, a little boy." His eyes don't move. You can still see inside them all the way to that house, the woman in the threshold, the icy road that you couldn't cross. "I tried," he says. "You did not try," you say. "You were on the other side of the road," he says. "You were too far away. I couldn't get to you." "You told me," you say, "that I could do it alone." "You were so angry," he says. You are both quiet now before your father says, "You never forgot that." The softness in his eyes is so clear, so obvious, that you experience it almost as you would a touch. Around them is the loose face of an old man, so old, so beaten and cut and bruised that it does not seem to respond to the warmth in his eyes, to move and feel with them, to belong to them, but you see it nonetheless. You see what he has never said, that he is sorry. And perhaps it is this that you want, that furious little boy wants, more than an explanation, more than a reason. And so you get up and clear the dishes, thinking that you were right to worry. You were right to come and see him now and not to wait. You walk out into the darkness to pee. The cold is bitter, and you stay close to the trailer to guard against the wind. When you come back in, he's easing slowly out of his pants and rolling into bed on the opposite side of the trailer from you. "Good night," you say, but he has turned away and is perhaps already sleeping. You rise several times that night and burrow a path through the dark with your flashlight until you find him, wake him, and ask him a series of questions. "What is your name? Do you know where you are? Do you know who I am?" Each time he answers them all, then turns and falls immediately back to sleep. You hear his breathing. Is it too loud, too labored, too slow? You wonder, above the wind outside. The dark is of a thickness that does not exist in the city, that allows no shapes, no edges, nothing to escape. And in it you sleep without dreams, without images or thoughts, so that your sleep is like a perfect absence. When you emerge from it in the morning, you forget for a moment where you are, who you are, that you are, just as you feared he might. And it is this fear that alerts you, wakes you fully. The light is chalky, without warmth or color, and when you see the lump in the sheets he makes, you worry that it is too still. You hurry to him. You try to wake him once more and are surprised when he turns, opens his eyes, and lifts his hands from the sheets, takes yours, which you offer again, pulls himself up, and then sits on his own.
Thank you, John, for allowing us to read that beautiful and moving story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Jesse Wren Marshall. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories are